Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Senate Republicans draft a final effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, and New Hampshire lawmakers, for the most part, give it a thumbs down. State's community college system takes heat after an audit raised financial reporting concerns, and lawmakers scrutinize failures of leadership at the Manchester VA Medical Center. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them this hour, and we'd like you to lend your voice to this conversation. What about this week's headlines do you want to know? What perspective can you share that will help your fellow listeners understand the issues? You can call 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner, executive editor of The Union Leader, and Paul Steinhauser, former CNN political editor and New Hampshire political reporter. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Good morning, Peter.
And just a reminder to our listeners that if listening to us is simply not enough, you can also watch us on live web stream at nhpr.org and on the Exchange's Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Love to have you tune in there as well. We're going to start this conversation today talking about the latest effort to repeal Obamacare, known as the Graham-Cassidy bill or Cassidy-Graham bill. Again, the phone number for you to lend your voice to this conversation, 1-800-892-6477. All right. So, Dean, tell us about this Graham-Cassidy bill. What would it do?
Well, there are some similarities to previous attempts at repealing and replacing Obamacare. We've talked about those in the past. This bill would end the individual mandate to purchase insurance. You'd no longer be required to do that. Employers would no longer be required to offer insurance. A couple of the areas where we've spent most of our time discussing whether or not legislation will pass are pre-existing conditions. The language in this current bill about pre-existing conditions is pretty vague, and Republicans have been at real pains to explain whether or not individuals with pre-existing conditions, if they are covered, will there be significant increases in their premiums, or will they actually be unable to get coverage at some point. So that's been sort of one big issue. The second big issue is the issue of block grants. This bill would end the expansion of Medicaid. It would keep some of the money that's being used to subsidize the exchanges, but it would take that money and redistribute it across all states in the form of block grants. And when you look at kind of how the federal dollars play out over, you know, roughly 10-year period, the figure we're hearing from the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services is that New Hampshire would lose roughly about $1 billion. So this really is an end to expanded Medicaid, which, in fairness, not all states decided to accept. I think they were in the maybe 32, around low 30s in terms of the number of states who expanded Medicaid. So those are the big issues. We've seen a lot of discussion about pre-existing conditions and a lot of discussion about whether or not these block grants are essentially, even though they give governors more flexibility, significant significant cuts in Medicaid funding over a 10-year period.
And why is this happening now, specifically before September 30th?
Yeah, well, September 30th is the end of the fiscal year. If they do this by September 30th, they can pass it in the Senate using budget reconciliation rules, which means you only need 50 votes. After September 30th, you go back to regular rules, they would need 60 votes to reach cloture and shut off any potential filibuster. So the rules right now, at least until September 30th, allow them to get this through with just 50 votes. And, you know, as was true for the last couple of attempts at repeal and replace, we've come down once again to Senators Rand Paul, Susan Collins, John McCain, and Lisa Murkowski. They seem to be the big four that are under the microscope in terms of which way they're going to go. Collins and Paul seem to be – Paul says he's a no. Collins seems to be losing no. And a lot of discussion now is about McCain, who when asked – doesn't really want to talk about how he's going to vote at this point. Remember, he was the deciding vote last time. And Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, where Medicaid is very important to that state, and there's a lot of negotiating going on about, you know, to the extent to which they would be hit by cuts in subsidies.
And one of the difficult things about this bill is that there's not a whole lot of time to sort of examine it and study it to see what's going on.
Right. There's not even really time for the congressional, the CBO to do the typical kind of assessment of what the impact is going to be. We're seeing some figures out there that, you know, 30 million people will lose their insurance over 10 years. That's being disputed by Republicans. But there's, you know, this is just kind of how Congress works these days. You get a firm deadline and stuff either gets rammed through or you go back to the drawing board at some point in the future.
And Paul Steinhauser, you were speaking with Senator Maggie Hassan about this, and she, like the other Democratic members of the congressional delegation, are opposed to it.
Yeah, there's a full court press by our delegation here in this state and Democrats across the country and progressive groups to stop Graham Cassidy in its tracks. But again, all politics is personal. And yesterday, Senator Hassan used a very personal example to illustrate the whole idea about pre-existing conditions. You're seeing that fight play out right now, too, with Jimmy Kimmel nationally. But there's a little boy in Concord. A three-year-old boy who suffers from a very serious spinal muscular disease, which is often fatal. He's been portrayed nationally before by Senator Shaheen. Senator Hassan visited with him yesterday. He needs very expensive life-saving drugs to basically survive. His folks are concerned that the whole idea of pre-existing conditions. I had a chance to talk with the senator after she met with the family. Take a listen.
And what Bodhi and his mom and dad showed us today is how things actually work and what will happen to Bodhi if he doesn't have health insurance coverage that is accessible, affordable, real, in real time, at a critical point for him so that he can get the treatment he needs, have as high a quality of life as he possibly can, and really this family get to live like any other family because they've got access to health care.
So overall, Democrats making an effort to sort of shape the debate around this Graham Cassidy legislation. Do you think they're successful, Paul?
To a degree, yeah, I do, because pre-existing conditions affect a lot of people in this country. And they've, you know, due to the current law, they don't face any discrimination. The big question now, and Dean was just talking about this, the new law doesn't take away pre-existing conditions, but it does allow the states flexibility to loosen some of the regulations that are currently mandated by Obamacare. And that's the sticking point right now between Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm. And some Republicans, including Governor Chris Sununu, are sort of lukewarm on this. He spoke on WBZ's Nightside program this week, weighed in on the Graham Cassidy bill. And he's been a big critic of Obamacare, but not really a big fan of this. Let's listen to what he said.
What I do love about this bill is the flexibility. What I don't love about this bill is it could cost New Hampshire somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion over 10 years. So, you know, they finally listened to us and put some of the flexibility and some of the opportunities for governors to really manage, you know, and design their own systems, which I love. But the financial impacts to this state, especially compared to other states who are getting billions of dollars more, the financial impact to New Hampshire is quite devastating. So nothing I can support at this time. I'm still hopeful it goes through the process, that it we have an opportunity to keep kind of putting input on it. Maybe there's some amendments. Maybe there's some tweaks that can bring it a little more into parity, giving everyone more of a fair deal. But I do like the flexibility. I think this is the last shot to repeal Obamacare, and that's incredibly important. But, you know, I think there's still a little work to be done on it.
So Trent Spinner of the union leader, I'll put this question to you. So he seems to be leaving the door open for changes to this legislation that would make it appealing to him.
That's right. And you have to remember all of this national talk about the health care plan for in terms of our coverage, what we're looking at is how does that impact how does that impact people here in New Hampshire? How does that affect voters here? And you have to remember the political reality here. A couple of years ago, before Medicaid expansion, New Hampshire hospitals had about a $400 million unfunded liability, which means that people who were not covered, even though they should have been, were showing up at local hospitals here, and hospitals were essentially eating the cost of their care to the tune of $400 million. And you had Republicans who have always, and including Chris Sununu, who are very supportive of block grants, actually got behind a compromise plan with Democrats to expand Medicaid here, and it covered an additional 50,000 lower-income people. And even local hospitals and insurance companies decided to kick in. The federal government only kicked in about 90% of the total cost for Medicaid expansion here. And the hospitals, local hospitals and insurance companies said, it's worth our investment to kick in the other 10%. The federal government's going to do this because it will lower our unfunded liability. So those people who are showing up at hospitals costing us $400 million will no longer – they'll have some kind of coverage. They'll have some sort of medical plan so they're not just showing up at the emergency room. And so Sununu has a difficult – is in a difficult position. While he supports block grants, the state also has Medicaid expansion at this point. And so for him to be able to go to block grants, he needs to figure out a plan to deal with people who don't who wouldn't have insurance and not cost the state $1 billion.
And Trent brings up a good point, because while the fight in Washington is ongoing, we're going to have a big fight right here in Concord at the State House next year, because that Medicaid expansion program sunsets at the end of next year. So it's going to be one of the big issues that the governor and the legislature are going to have to deal with starting in January, and it's going to get pretty ugly.
Okay, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and we're talking about the Graham Cassidy bill. In just a moment after the break, we're going to be talking about the community college system audit and the congressional field hearing held Monday, looking at the failures of leadership at the Manchester VA. You can call about those topics now to join the discussion in about 10, 15 minutes or so, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us if you have questions or comments, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to the phones now and talk to Dave in Bedford. Dave, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, just reacting to that Fed senator's comments, she actually actively prevented Clayton Holton from getting the aid that he needed when he wanted to be able to take marijuana.
Clayton Holton, I'm not familiar with that person. Can you explain a little bit?
Well, he's dead now, so maybe it doesn't matter as much, but she actively stopped people from getting marijuana. She's got no business talking about how some individual will benefit from her care when she's actively interfered with people getting the care that they need.
Do you dispute the fact that this young boy needs the treatment and that the health care plan being considered in the Senate would do nothing for his care?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling, Dave. I appreciate that. So, Dave, question about the use of a person who might be affected by this legislation. Safe to say that this kind of legislation might affect a lot of people. We're just not sure yet how.
My sense of what Dave is getting at is that back when we were going through the legislative process of getting medical marijuana approved in the state, it was a very long, drawn-out process. Governor Hassan was sort of very, very tough on sort of the list of conditions that would be included. And so some people expressed concern that, A, it was too restrictive. It has since been widened a bit to include other conditions like PTSD that was too restrictive, and then it took way too long to get into effect. My guess is that's what he was referring to and saying that this is in some way a little hypocritical, given that he views her as kind of an obstacle to having brought medical marijuana to the state quickly.
Huh. All right. So
that's my guess.
Perhaps an apples and oranges comparison in any event. But let me ask you something, Dean, about this legislation, because, you know, this is the third try in the past year that we've seen to repeal this the Obamacare legislation. Can we expect yet another piece of legislation from the House or the Senate if this one doesn't make it before the September 30th deadline?
I think it'll be very difficult. I think, you know, as we're seeing, they can barely get the 50 votes necessary to pass it under budget reconciliation. Once that goes away, it becomes an impossible task to get 60. I know that President Trump is sort of chomping at the bit to do tax reform, as are other Republicans. We haven't even talked about infrastructure in a while, and the debt ceiling is going to come back around in December. So it's probably, you know, you never say never. This is kind of this Graham Cassidy bill kind of snuck up on people, but it just seems really unlikely.
How essential is health care to tax reform?
Well, I mean, there's issues in terms of you have to deal with the potential potential cost of the healthcare program in order to then get a more accurate sense of how to craft tax reform. That had been the planning, and I think that was one of the complaints of President Trump had been that Congress, in particular Speaker Ryan and the House, felt that they needed to move on healthcare first before they could do the other pieces of legislation. And Trump seems very eager to get on to tax reform.
Okay, let's take another call and go to Barbara in Walpole. Barbara, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yes, hi. Excuse me. I had heard that in this bill, the block grants would not have to be used for health care. They could be used any way the state wanted to use them. Does anyone there know if that's true or not?
I'm not sure. I haven't heard anything about the block grants being used for something other than health care, though the argument that I think Governor Sununu made was that the block grants allow for more state flexibility on how it is used for health care, right?
Well, that's certainly true. I don't whether or not you can just take the money and use it for other unrelated issues. I'm just not sure. So I don't want to.
That seems like
that, but
seems like a reach. Yeah,
yeah. Let's not speculate too much on that. But so all these pieces of legislation this year, has any sense of what effect, if any, they've had on the insurance market?
A lot of inflexibility, obviously. And it was a big drama here in New Hampshire whether the top three insurers were going to stay on the exchanges. And we didn't find out until late last month, just before the deadline, that they were. Insurers don't like, insurance companies like stability. And there is anything but stability right now when it comes to health care. It's also going to be an issue again looking ahead to next year with Medicaid expansion, because we think we're going to have Obamacare again next year, but that's still don't know for sure.
Not a guarantee.
Instability is not a good thing.
Yeah. Wanted to bring it up just because there's such a stark contrast between, you know, this Graham Cassidy legislation and the legislation offered up by Bernie Sanders last week. Dean, could the contrast be any starker?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been proposing and getting a lot of Democratic support in the Senate for the idea. He calls it Medicare for All, kind of basically a version of single payer, in which the government would be the healthcare provider. I think the biggest impact of Sanders' proposal is going to be on the Democratic primary for president in 2020. It doesn't really have any chance of passing right now, but it is certainly pulling the discourse in the Democratic Party to the left.
Here's the most interesting thing I found out about this, especially when it comes to New Hampshire's delegation. Gene Shaheen, Maggie Hassan have been on the same page when it comes to health care, on everything. On this, they disagree. Shaheen came out and supported Senator Sanders' tax single-payer Medicare for All bill. Hassan has not. And I asked her yesterday, I said, this is bizarre because you two are really always on the same page. She said she has some concerns about Sanders' plan, especially when it comes to cost and the kind, she said, quote unquote, the kind of destruction that moving to that kind of system might have. But I think both of our senators here are realistic. Senator Sanders' bill is never going to become law, not with this Congress, which is controlled by Republicans.
What thing was shocking to me was that after decades in public service, Gene Shaheen came out for this. She had never really expressed support for a plan like this. I think it was actually, in terms of all the New Hampshire politics stories in the last few weeks, I thought that was the one that flew most under the radar. It was pretty surprising to me, and it actually the first thing I thought of when I saw it was, is she going to run again?
Yeah, that's everybody wonders, will she run in 2020? I still think that's a long way away. She doesn't have to make a decision for at least a year. But I agree with you. That was an early tip. Maybe she's thinking about running one more time.
I thought it was more than an early tip. I thought that press release announcing the Medicare for All, that was her reelection campaign beginning right there.
Huh. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Trent Spinner, executive editor of The Union Leader, and Paul Steinhauser, former CNN political editor and New Hampshire political reporter. If you have questions, questions about the week's news, something the press didn't catch perhaps, let us know. You can call 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. After the break, we're going to be talking about the state community college system, which has taken heat recently from state regulators over fiscal management issues. We'll also be talking about the Manchester VA and the congressional field hearing held earlier this week about failures of leadership at the Manchester VA. Call in with your questions or comments. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, and we will be right back.
On the coast of Northern California, you've got some fog, things are dewy, everything smells like the earth.
Foraging for mushrooms connects us to our roots as hunter-gatherers. But there are risks.
Unanimously, people report that it was a very delicious mushroom, even as they're dying.
Mycophobes and mycophiliacs square off on the latest Outside In podcast. Download Outside In on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and New Hampshire political reporter Paul Steinhauser. It's been a busy week for reporters in New Hampshire, and now is your chance to get some answers to questions about what's been happening in the week's news in the Granite State. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the congressional field hearing looking into failures of leadership at the Manchester VA. Call about that now to join the discussion. When it starts, the number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to talk first about that community college audit that's been happening. We'll start with you, Trent. Trent Spinner from the Union Leader. A performance audit carried out by state regulators identified 29 areas of concern in how the state community college system manages its financial budgeting and reporting processes. Trent, what exactly was the system not doing correctly?
So as our State House Bureau Chief, the Union Leaders Bureau Chief Dave Solomon reported, the community college system received about $40 million last fiscal year, and there were just a number of questions around how they spent that money. For example, one school received about $8,200 per student, while another school received $2,800 per student. One of the college presidents bought a new Honda Pilot with leather interior, using state funds. Another
for himself, for the school, or
for himself.
Oh,
yep, a personal vehicle. And it turned out there were all kinds of issues with personal vehicles. There were if you get a chance, go to unionleader.com. You can see the report there. I think some people might be shocked at some of the vehicles that we're paying college presidents to drive around, including very high end vehicles.
Wow.
There was a college president held an inauguration event for himself that cost about $34,000, including food, a band, audio setup, a $500 poem that was commissioned just for the event, bagpipers. Now, they used some of that as a fundraising event, but there were just a lot of questions about how some of this money was being spent. And the board, the Board of Trustees, basically they've been working on, this was a four-year audit, they've been working on fixing some of these issues and putting policies in place. And if you look at each individual instance, you know, there was always a reason. This wasn't like there was nothing totally egregious about it. There just weren't policies in place for how to spend state money. After this report came out, there was some fallout, and state legislators were pretty concerned about the lack of procedures in place for spending this money and wanted some answers.
Just for listeners, we're talking about seven campuses around the state, about almost 10,000 students. And, you know, to sort of add on to what Trent was saying, if you remember back a year or two, there were complaints about the administration of the community college system being too administratively top heavy, too many senior positions, salary increases, and faculty, adjunct faculty, and some other faculty being cut. Basically, you know, and their argument was it's based on demand for different programs. But at the time, there was some concern that there was too much money being spent at the senior administrative level. And I think the study points out there's a fair bit of redundancy. You have multiple vice presidents at each campus, et cetera. So we've heard concerns about this for some time, even before this report came out.
And Trent, are these audits sort of routine, or was this one called for any reason?
This one was called for. I don't know if they are specifically routine. I do know that Senator Reagan, he's from Deerfield, he's the chairman there's a study committee in the legislature looking at public higher education. He was pretty upset. He had a lot of questions about this. He was worried that there weren't more procedures in place, and so I think they're going to be working with state legislators on it.
Okay. If you are a student in the state community college system, do you have something to say about this? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Trent, how has the community college system responded so far to this audit?
Well, and this has been an ongoing process that just really became public. What they're doing right now is they're working with their trustees and with state legislators to put more procedures in place so that's more even, and so that there's an understanding of, all right, if we're going to take this $40 million from the state, here's where it's supposed to go and here's how we're supposed to use it.
So is there a sense of when all these audit issues raised in the audit are going to be corrected? I assume it's not going to be overnight.
It's not going to be overnight, and I think some have already been corrected and they're working on others. So it's an ongoing process.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guest today about the week's news. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the mayoral primary results in Manchester. If you're in Manchester, you have something to say about politics in the city, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. So let's switch gears now. Talk about the field hearing that took place in Pembroke on Monday. Congresswoman Annie Custer called the field hearing looking into the alleged failure of leadership at the Manchester VA Medical Center. They were looking into why, excuse me, so many patients allegedly suffered harm, not because they received bad care, but because the bureaucracy there let some patients with spine conditions degenerate. There were other issues, too. Congressman Jack Bergman, a Republican from Michigan, was one of the most aggressive members of the panel looking at that failure of leadership. And he set his sights on Dr. Michael Mayo Smith, the network director of the VA New England system, who oversees VA hospitals in the New England states, including Manchester, White River Junction. He had reportedly heard about some of these incidents and decided not to act on them, saying that they were local issues. And Representative Bergman had this to say to Dr. Mayo Smith near the conclusion of the field hearing.
Dr. Mayo Smith, you stated, quote, "My responsibility is to listen and respond," end quote. It should not take a news report or a congressional hearing for VA leadership to respond to veterans' and employees' concerns. As a VISN director, your job is to lead proactively, not reactively.
So that's Congressman Jack Bergman from Michigan calling out the network director of the New England VA system. Trent, what do you make of the reports of this field hearing about what the Manchester VA has been up to lately?
What was interesting to me was some of the things that were not happening yet. I think there was a lot of public testimony about what has been done so far. But what was interesting to me was some of the reports that were submitted for the record that my colleague Mark Hayward at the Union Leader wrote about, where some people were being punished. There was one administrator who had been moved because he was a whistleblower. There were a couple of issues that they were still dealing with. In that original report, there was a very expensive imaging camera. I don't actually even know what it does, but it sounds really fancy. And part of the original complaint was that it hadn't. Wasn't being used. They spent all this money on this camera, and it's still not being used. And there's been nothing that has moved on that yet. So I think it sounds like, despite all of the attention, despite all of the hearings that we've had and the politicians who have gotten involved, it sounds like they're still struggling with a number of issues at the Manchester VA.
And joining me on the line now is Stuart Levinson, who worked at the Manchester VA for many years and is one of the dozen whistleblowers who has come forward with allegations of mismanagement. Stuart, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stuart, so you published yesterday in the Concord Monitor an op-ed saying that this congressional field hearing didn't really fulfill its purpose to the extent that you would have liked it to, which is to look at the failures of leadership at the Manchester VA that led to this problem in the first place. Why do you say that the field hearing didn't sort of live up to its expectations?
Well, it covered a lot of material, but I thought by the title of it would be much more focused on leadership failings, which is, I think, what really needed to be studied. For example, Schlosser and Oker, the two administrators that were removed, they're still VA employees. They would have had no choice if they were invited. They would have had to show up. And I think they could have given some real meat of what was going on there. Also, while General Bergman criticized Dr. Mayo Smith, it seemed like heavy criticism at the time, but that was the hardest criticism of the whole 2.5-hour hearing. So I think a lot more could have been said and done, a lot more examined. I mean, it certainly didn't cut to the actual nuts and bolts of where leadership failed. As a matter of fact, when General Bergman said that Dr. Mayo Smith wasn't proactive, he was reactive, I thought that was giving him too much credit. There were some real failings there. There are still some real failings going on there. Most departments don't even have a chairman right now. The search process may take 6 months or longer. They really need to get their act together and start moving in a forward direction.
It was mentioned at the field hearing this week, Stuart, that the investigations that were launched as a response of in response to all the allegations that came out in the Boston Globe in July should be completed within 2 to 4 weeks. Are you optimistic that the investigation is going to be satisfactory, is going to actually identify the issues that need to be addressed?
Well, they took a lot of testimony. There were a lot of witnesses, including myself. Hopefully, they'll be honest brokers this time. As Dr. Coyes and myself have been saying all along, he said on Monday, the original OMI investigation was a sham, that it may have even been incompetent, depending on whether the charts were ever actually opened or not. So I'm having a wait-and-see attitude. I keep on remaining hopeful because I believe everyone's goals are the same. No one wants to deliver poor care to our veterans, but things have to move forward.
Stuart Levinson is one of the 12 whistleblowers who has come forward since July alleging mismanagement of care at the Manchester VA. Stuart, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We've got this email from someone who has experienced, has been to the Manchester VA. It says, my recent visit was June 2017 and they did poorly. Now I drive to White River Junction, Vermont. They do a much better job. That's from Matthew, who is a veteran of the Iraq War. And he says he needs VA health assistance. So now he's going to the White River Junction. But, you know, there have been reports, Trent, in the Union Leader, and Paul, I'm sure you've seen these as well, where veterans have a variety of experience at these VA hospitals.
Right. After our first series of stories about this, we got calls. We were swamped in the newsroom with veterans who wanted to talk about how great their care was. And I talked to a number of them, just readers who wanted to call up and express their opinion. And it was always great to hear that a number of people felt like they were getting the care they needed. But when we talked to the whistleblowers, what they said was that these are veterans and they're used to waiting. They're used to following orders and they don't understand that they are not getting the care that they really deserve. Think about it. If you are only going to the Manchester VA or even White River Junction and you just don't know what it's like to go to Dartmouth or another hospital, you don't know that you're not getting the care that you need or that the care is not as advanced as it can be. So, I think that is part of what's going to come out as this report unfolds. But it was heartening to hear all of the positive stories.
Mm-hmm. Trent really hit on that. And I reported this 2 or 3 years ago for NH1 News. You know, New Hampshire is one of the few states, if maybe the only state, that doesn't have a full service VA hospital.
In the lower 48.
In the lower 48, exactly. So they have to go to White River Junction or down to Massachusetts for the simple stuff, for the basic stuff. Manchester does a great job, but, and you've heard a lot of veterans say that, they've said it to me, but, this has been a big issue in this state, and now it's getting even bigger.
And the issue is there's really no good way to measure that. There's no, besides the anecdotal phone calls that we get, or, you know, if you go, if you're a reporter, I've had my reporters just kind of spend some time in the parking lot talking to people, and it's all very anecdotal. And so I think when we're really first going to see how much of an impact this had, this has had, is in the upcoming election. I think that voters will either decide to hold people who were in power now, including our delegation, responsible for what they see as problems at the VA, or they may say, you know what, we understand there were problems, we think they're getting fixed, and we're ready to move on.
Yeah, the two concerns for me that I think Stewart emphasized, the first was that the former director and the chief of staff of the facility were not at this hearing to testify, and there's still work for the VA. As Stewart mentioned, they could have been compelled to testify. I'm not sure why they weren't there. I think that would have been useful. And the second thing is this issue that in the past, the kind of internal investigations have not been particularly strong, and there was some concern by these whistleblowers that bringing the same organization within the institution back in to do the study would not be the way to go.
And then candidate Donald Trump, running for president, made the VA a huge issue, continues to talk about it. That's why this is even more in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm. And in the budget, there was an increase for the Department of Veterans Affairs, but you could throw a lot of money at a problem and still not solve it. So, I mean, what could happen? And all three members of the congressional delegation who were there, Carol Shea Porter was not there, but both senators and Congresswoman Custer were there, were talking about making it full service, meaning like what you were talking about earlier, Paul, right? Like they were talking about having inpatient care. There's really no inpatient care to speak of at the Manchester VA. So will that happen? Is there money? Is there a chance? Is there the political will to turn the Manchester VA into a quote-unquote full-service VA medical center sort of remains to be seen. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire political reporter, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. And with you, if you've got questions about the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I want to talk a little bit about the Manchester mayoral primary. This may spill over to the other side of the break, but we do want to touch on this because the city of Manchester held its primary. Incumbent Mayor Ted Gatsis and former Alderman Joyce Craig were expected to get the two top spots and advance to the general election. So, Paul, any surprises in this race?
Yeah, a couple surprises. For the first time since Manchester started holding nonpartisan primaries 2 decades ago, the incumbent lost. Yeah, he didn't come out, or he didn't have the most votes. Ted Gatsis was about 800 votes behind Joyce Craig, the former alderman who is the Democratic, who's the top Democratic candidate.
Right.
Again, a nonpartisan election, but let's be honest, it's a very partisan election.
And given the turnout, 800 votes is pretty significant, yes?
It is, and considering the two candidates that were also running for mayor that didn't make the cut, they between them only got 200 votes. So Democrats are crowing. They think this is great going into the general election, which is 6.5 weeks away. Gatsis and his team, they say, wait a minute, you know what? We actually picked up more votes this time than we did 2 years ago in the primary 2 years ago. This is going to be a very tough rematch. Remember, Craig lost to Gatsis by only 64 votes last time around. I spoke to some sources this morning. They told me that Gatsis is going to be putting out a full court press going ward to ward, but also expect to see Governor Sununu. This is what my sources tell me. Expect to see Governor Sununu on the campaign trail with Ted Gatsis pretty soon.
And earlier in this month, Paige Sutherland had a fantastic story about Hassan Essa, who was a 20-year-old running for alderman in Manchester, someone who grew up super interested in politics. Any sense on how he did, or just sort of way too down the ballot?
I can tell you, he did. He got 289 votes in Ward 12. He came in second place behind Keith Hirschman, who's a favorite to win. Hirschman got just under 400 votes. And just going back to Paul's anyway, so Hassan Essa is going to be on the ballot.
Yeah.
Just going back to Paul's point about Democrats really crowing over this election. So a couple of things to keep in mind. There was last time where Joyce Craig lost by just a couple dozen votes. There was actually another person, and I know it's nonpartisan, but he was a Democrat, Tom Arnold, who was also on the ballot. And if you look at the percentage, the total percentage of votes that Ted Gatsis got this time versus last time, he actually did better this time around. And talking to people on that side of the campaign, what they were saying was it's very difficult to get Republicans in Manchester to turn out in the primary. And so I think that when I woke up the next morning and I saw, well, wow, that was quite the vote difference. They're not as concerned as the Democrats might want us to think.
Okay. And this was the preseason. The main game, the real game, is coming up in November.
All right. I have more questions for you guys about the Manchester politics in Manchester and what's at stake in this mayoral race. After the break, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. And we're speaking with Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire political reporter, and Trent Spinner of The Union Leader. And with you, I hope. Give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page where we have a live video stream of what's happening in the studio right now. You can find that NHPR Exchange on Facebook. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Trent Spinner of The Union Leader, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Call us with your questions about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about Manchester mayoral politics, and I wanted to put a question to Trent Spinner of The Union Leader about what in Manchester is going to drive people to the polls this November. What's the issue on people's minds?
That's a great question. And actually, the Gatzes campaign put out a survey to Manchester voters asking them that very question. They put out this is not a scientific survey, and we generally try and err away from surveys, but they got 2,500 responses. They said that according to their survey, the Gatzes campaign, so take that with whatever grain of salt you'd like to, property taxes, 53% of people said that that was the most important issue for them. The opioid epidemic came in second with 38% of respondents. Education was close by, but 35%. Public safety tied education, 35%, and roads and transportation just behind that at 34%. And so what the Gatzes campaign has really been trying to do is talk about those big issues. Gatzes has always vetoed a tax cap override. Craig is supportive of additional spending or investment, as she calls it. For Gatzes, what he's trying to do, the campaign is trying to do, is kind of show that they are getting the roads paved, that they're going to keep taxes down, that they're working on the opioid epidemic. And Craig is going to try to say, hey, the roads, and you can see this already, the roads aren't where they need to be. The opioid epidemic is still out of control in Manchester. So those are the top issues that I think they're going to be focusing on.
Here's why this election is so significant politically. At 110,000 people, Manchester, by far New Hampshire's largest city, but also the largest city in northern New England. It's the only major election here in New Hampshire this fall. And some people, especially on the Democratic side, are seeing this as maybe a barometer of things to come in 2018. A lot of Republicans will dispute that, saying this is really an election about Manchester and the issues that Trent just talked about. But that's why this election, you're going to see a big ground game from both campaigns. You're going to see a lot of radio ads, and you're going to see some people, even some potential Democratic candidates who are thinking about 2020 in the White House, come here. We've already seen that. We got Martin O'Malley coming next week.
Yeah, because it's an off-year election, and it really is kind of the biggest game in town. It's going to have the feel of a U.S. Senate election, given the visibility and people coming in from outside the campaign. And I know that certainly both sides will be looking to interpret the results as some bigger statement about 2018, for sure.
And where would we reporters be without an election?
Exactly. We live for this.
Great. All right. Well, let's switch gears a little bit, talk about Northern Pass, because, Trent, the State Committee considering Northern Pass has ordered the project's construction panel to return to address what they're calling potential inaccuracies in the plans. The Union Leader's been doing some reporting on this. What inaccuracies are they looking at?
So the issue is that this plan is going to, the Northern Pass project is going to stretch 100 miles. And they're down to the point of talking about what culverts will be affected and what, sewer pipes will be affected. And so part of the issue, according to the State Department of Transportation, is that some of the plans presented by Northern Pass engineers did not have all the information or did not have accurate information about where some of these kind of like the nitty-gritty of the project now, where some of that stuff is. And so here they are spending time working with Northern Pass to, you know, move this culvert or, you know, this side road or whatever they have to do to make the project happen. And the plans being submitted by Northern Pass were not accurate. And so that added to the time that state engineers had to spend on this. Northern Pass and Eversource and, you know, they've all now said that they're doing a better job and that it seems like the problem has been resolved.
And I think part of the issue was that they were asking for what are called exception requests to the Department of Transportation has certain requirements that dictate how you bury underground utilities. And I think some of the Northern Pass proposal had asked for some exceptions to this, and there was some concern that it was reflected in these inaccuracies in the reports. And, you know, we've been talking about this on the roundup now for a couple of years, the issues have consistently been the burying of the lines. How much? How's it gonna be done? What's the cost? And the height of the towers. We just went through a whole argument about the height of the towers here in Concord, and some might be higher than the Capitol Dome, and you would see them throughout the city, et cetera, et cetera. So those have been the two consistent issues with this have been how much is going to be buried, the related cost, and then the height of these towers, and it always comes back to some aspect of those issues.
So we're not talking about whether Northern Pass is going to be reality, but how?
It certainly seems to be slowly moving in that direction. They're certainly further along than they have been. They've got some federal permits. There's still more to do. The Site Evaluation Committee has kind of pushed off its final decision. I think they're going to do, they said,
February
is the oral decision, and then a written report in March, which is a little bit later than they had planned. You know, and then the other debated bit, I should really throw in a third part there in addition to, you know, burying height of towers is the, you know, how much is New Hampshire going to get out of it in terms of the power, or are we just sort of a conduit to get to southern New England?
Right. Okay. Well, let's switch gears and talk about Sunapee boat access, because that was also in the news yet again this week. Governor Chris Sununu on Tuesday established a commission to help decide the future of the controversial wild goose property along Lake Sunapee in Newbury. Dean, can you bring us up to speed on this one as well? I mean, this project also been in the works for many years.
Yeah, this has been going on for many, many years. We're talking about a 3.3-acre parcel of land on Lake Sunapee in Newbury, and the Department of Fish and Game has had planned to put in a boat slip that would allow you to use your SUV or truck to back in your boat into the water. And I think there were going to be something like roughly 30 parking spaces for SUVs and trailers on this particular piece of property. And it was a $2 million project, and the legislature failed to approve it. It's been going on for a while. Fish and Game has spent about $400,000 on engineering. Governor Sununu has gotten involved and is now established this 15-member commission, including, I think, something like six members from the affected towns, to figure out what to do with this piece of property, and also to look for possible alternatives to give more public access to the lake for boats.
And why is the governor doing this now, Trent?
That's a great question. You know, this has been going on for almost 20 years, and the governor basically used his ability. The governor can submit stuff to the executive council, and this had been waiting on executive council approval, and he basically revoked that submission. And so that was a good question. We have done some reporting. Some of our political reporters at the Union Leader have tried to dig in to see if there were some campaign finance things happening here, you know, where people along Lake Sunapee donated a lot of money to the governor, and is that how they got his ear? And we didn't find anything. It seems to be an issue that has been very sticky for him. I am not entirely sure that the governor's office was ready for the amount of pushback and conversation that was going to happen about this. And if you see our story from the Union Leader, from one of our correspondents, B. Lewis, you'll see that even at the Fish and Game Commission, they're still very upset about this.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like the potential for a political win is pretty big, right? If there's this problem that's been around for 20 years and he can come in and solve it. Pretty good for the governor.
I guess so. But, you know, on both sides of this issue, we haven't heard from many people. Like we have always been asking, hey, if you are very supportive of the wild goose site, let us know. Besides the Fish and Game commissioners who are saying, hey, listen, under state law, we have to provide access to Lake Sunapee. Besides those people, I mean, like, I'm looking for a Joe the Plumber type person who can call up the union leader. We'd love to do a story with you about how you can't bring your kids fishing on Lake Sunapee right now. But I haven't heard anything like that. So, and I, you know, I know that there is opposition to the wild goose. But my biggest wonder is, how many people does this really affect? Right? Is this just a couple of people who live on Lake Sunapee, or is there a bigger issue here? So I don't know how many political points the governor is going to win or lose on this one.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guests today about the week's news. Give us a call with your questions. There is still time to do so. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your thoughts to our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange. Also this week, Phillips Exeter Academy and the Exeter Police Department have announced a new agreement concerning the reporting of sexual assaults on campus. Dean, what's the story behind this?
Yeah, well, you know, we've talked a number of times on the roundup about the issues at Exeter and St. Paul dealing with sexual abuse and how these respective institutions have dealt with it. There's been kind of a larger reflection and thinking about this issue with a number of these elite boarding schools around the country, some of whom have disclosed issues they've had in the past in the 60s and 70s and 80s. There's also been some recent issues with Exeter and St. Paul's, but Exeter, in any event, has now a new memo of understanding with the local police about procedures to help keep students safe from abuse, an agreement that anything that any potential assaults will be immediately reported to state and local authorities. They've set up sort of a pipeline for counseling and support to a local nonprofit. And I think also there's going to be some new annual training for faculty and staff. So they'd received a lot of criticism for how they dealt with the recent recent cases. And so this is kind of the outcome of that process. But this has been a bigger issue for the last year or two among elite boarding schools generally around the country.
Seem to have entered the lightning round portion of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We've got a few more stories that we want to touch on before the end of the hour. Another one being, of course, Indigenous Peoples Day. The town of Durham is the first in New Hampshire to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day to be celebrated on Columbus Day after town councilors approved this idea on Monday. Paul Steinhauser, what's the reasoning behind this?
This has been an issue that we've heard about nationally. The vote wasn't even close, and I think it was like 7-2 or 8-2 in Durham. I think there's no surprise that Durham, which is a very progressive town, would be one of the first, if not the first, in New Hampshire to do this. We all know the story about Columbus, Native Americans, and the issue there, and Durham leading the way in New Hampshire.
And, I mean, it's not replacing Columbus Day, right? It's just happening in addition to Columbus Day?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Columbus Day is a federal holiday, so right. They can't replace. This is in addition to.
Yeah, and I think their hope is that there will be some sort of conversation about the impact of the, you know, Westerners coming to America and the impact on Native Americans.
Yeah, there was some opposition to this though, and it came from in a form of a letter from Antonio Sestito of the Sons of Italy in America, out of Massachusetts. Though, of course, the Sons of Italy has members in all states here. And he wrote a letter saying, quote, though we recognize that gruesome incidents took place and cannot be condoned, this was no different from how Europeans treated other Europeans or Native Americans treated other Native Americans at that point in time. Today's concept of individual rights was simply non-existent during the 15th century. Does the town of Durham plan on desecrating George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and our forefathers at large for owning slaves their entire lives? That's from Antonio Sestino of the Sons of Italy. Apparently, that argument did not hold water with the town of Durham's committee.
It did not. And this also ties into what happened in Charlottesville and Confederate statues. And, of course, for a little history here, you know, while Columbus did sail for Spain, he's Italian. It's for Italian-Americans, it's one of the biggest holidays of the year.
Yeah. And you have to remember the politics of Durham, too. I mean, I think that something like this could really only pass in Durham, Hanover, Keene. I don't see something like this happening in Derry, Londonderry, Salem, you know, that more conservative part of the state.
This is a college town thing is what you're saying.
I'm saying it's not necessarily a college town thing, but those towns are definitely more liberal.
Portsmouth in there.
Portsmouth, definitely in there. So this is when I saw this come through, I said, yep, Durham. Okay.
All right. All right. Well, two more stories. Let's hope we can touch on them quickly. DCYF, a state health official from New Jersey, has been tapped to serve as the new leader of New Hampshire's Division of Children, Youth, and Families. Trent, who is this person?
Joe Ripsom is a former private practice family law attorney, a middle school English teacher. He's the current deputy commissioner of the D.C., the equivalent of DCYF in New Jersey. He manages about 6,700 employees. He's in charge of all the legal and legislative, the policy development, licensing efforts of the department. So a pretty high-level job, and he will start in New Hampshire in October 27th, and we certainly hope he likes skiing.
But meanwhile, there's an oversight agency for DCYF still looking for a leader for that position.
They are still looking for a leader. There is a legislative committee, a study commission, essentially, that includes the Manchester police chief and Senator Carson from Londonderry. And they're looking at ways to hire this person. They were talking at their most recent meeting. They were talking about just getting a good old fashioned job posting out, letting people apply and figure out the procedure. Right now, they had been kind of looking for people. They'd been going out searching for people. And one of the arguments Chief Willer made was, let's open this up a little bit more.
Okay. And finally, Paul, Governor Sununu still trying hard to bring Amazon to New Hampshire.
Yeah, this is a big deal. The online retail behemoth is looking for a new global headquarters, a second one. We're talking about 50,000 jobs. I had a chance to speak with the governor on Tuesday, and guess what? The interview made a lot of news, which you saw on the Concord Monitor. He said he is personally involved with what he describes as a very aggressive bid by our state to land this second headquarters. He said he's met with Jeff Bezos. He says, we're putting a package together now. Quickly, he also took a shot at his predecessor, Maggie Hassan, and the Democratic governor before her, Lynch, because he said that we are in a better position today because of what he said he's done the last 7 months to even make this kind of attempt to land a headquarters like Amazon than we were during these Democratic administrations.
And of course, this is something Governor Sununu ran on, right? The ability to bring businesses into New Hampshire.
Yep, exactly. 100 businesses in 100 days was his pledge that he was going to meet with them and try to bring the jobs into New Hampshire. Workforce development was a big part of his campaign for governor.
This is going to be the bidding war to end all bidding wars.
But here's
the
problem for New Hampshire, though. You can't, no financial incentives.
Right,
we can't do that in this state. That's one of the reasons why GE didn't come here and went to Boston instead. It puts New Hampshire at a big disadvantage, but it's still going to be an interesting bid.
All right. Well, that has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I want to thank our panel of esteemed reporters, Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader and political reporter, Paul Steinhauser. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Peter.
And listeners, remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook at nhpr.org. We're still getting emails from earlier in the show when we spoke about the VA. Mary wrote in to recommend, why are we surprised at the failure of leadership at the VA? It's almost impossible to fire government workers, whether it's VA, military, or any agency. Even if they are incompetent, they just get moved around, is what Mary says. She says, remember when the new VA had tried to solve the wait period? It's like trying to move an oil tanker. Thanks for that. That's Mary in Plymouth. Also, Jane in Manchester says Hassan Essa should be congratulated for bluntly stating what many of us have felt for a long time. Quote, Manchester is so stagnant, it's almost toxic. For anyone from Manchester who's lived elsewhere and returned here, it feels like virtually the same as it did as 25 or 30 years ago. That's Jane from Manchester. Thank you very much. Again, conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.